Hey, this is Sunny. If you're listening, you're listening on the iTunes feed. Make sure you sign up at the Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com, sign up to Patreon. We've got exclusive bonus episodes that'll live there forever. The most recent is about sex, love, goop. You'll never guess who shows up for a review. Gene is back. Only at the Patreon, though. So go sign up there. Listen to Sex, Love, Goop. I'm really excited for the bonus episode that we're going to be taping here shortly about... essentially, let me elevator pitch it to you this way. It's Vic Mattis explains Mulholland Drive to JBL and Sonny, which I don't know if you know anything about Vic or Mulholland Drive, but it should be a fun episode. So listen to this episode, which is about the French Dispatch, and it's a bunch of journalists talking about a movie about journalists, so very exciting stuff. And go over to subbeacon.com, sign up for the Patreon, and you'll get some great bonus stuff that you'll never get here on the iTunes feed, okay? See you over there.
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into the French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people.
It's supposed to be charming.
He assembled a team of the best expatriate journalists of his time. Berenson, Sazerac, Kremenz, Roebuck Wright. These were his people.
Just try to make it sound like you wrote it that way on purpose.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Jonathan V. Last and Sunny Bunch. Just a reminder, The Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com. You'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and don't forget about The Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. Gentlemen, how are we? I know that people are probably going to listen to this in reverse, but I'll say it anyway. What a delight to have Paul Crookston on our special Squid Game episode.
We tape the special episode. Usually we tape the special episode at the end, after we tape the main episode. But we did it in reverse this week because we wanted to have Paul Crookston, a Korea expert, on the show. And he was very good. JVL got to ask him serious questions. I got to ask him unserious questions.
And I got to have him here in person in my basement.
Vic got to put his tongue in Paul's ear.
That's not true at all. That's how close they were.
I think on
a couple. First of all, the cushion is still warm. The seat's still warm.
Do you like wood?
And it's like, and you
what
know what
kind of wood? Hardwood.
You know, Sonny. Very few people. JVL. Very few people even know that commercial anymore. And you're always trying to push it. No, I love having Paul. He's so adorable. He's sleeping right there in the corner. He's sleeping.
I love that guy. It made just made me happy to see his face.
Yeah, same.
I love him.
Likewise.
Love that guy.
Likewise. Okay, so how are you guys doing, Sonny? What's going on?
Not a whole lot. You know, it was Halloween. It was Halloween last on Sunday, and we took the kids out to do the trick or treating, and
that was fine.
But the real highlight, weirdly, was when we came back. The kids helped pass out. So we have like a table set up in our front yard, right? Like on the little path, the entryway to the house. I guess a remnant of lockdown, whatever. But we had the table set up, and we had the kids were out there helping it pass it around. And my youngest, who just turned three, he was more excited to hand out the candy than he was to actually go to the houses and get it. He was like,
"That's a funny thing."
He was so excited. He would see some kids coming, and he would be like, "The big kids are coming! The big kids are coming! The big kids are coming!"
Aww.
And he would grab handfuls, and he would run up to them and like shove his hand in their back, to the point that like some of the kids were like getting like, "Stop putting your hand in my candy bag, little boy! I don't know what you're doing." But it was very funny. And so then he would say like, "Happy Halloween." And they would go, "Oh, thanks." And he'd be like, "You're welcome." It was all very funny. It was delightful. He was a delight. And
that's wonderful.
And Halloween was again more fun handing out the candy than getting the candy. So that's what's going on in my life.
We had an innovation a Halloween innovation this year.
Halloween innovation.
I think we're going to have to do every year. Two of my priest buddies are visiting and staying with us, which is great. Father Harrison and Father Anthony. Father Harrison is a baseball card guy. And so whenever he comes, we go out, we get a bunch of boxes of baseball cards, and me and him and the big kids, we sit and we rip them. We break them and we look for the hits and we get autographs, memorabilia, relics, and all that. Anyway, you wind up, when you get this, just a lot of what we refer to as common cards, cards that aren't actually worth anything. And so this year, because we ripped a lot of cards, we had a lot of common cards, and we decided to put them in the candy basket with the candy. So kids could get a baseball card or a basketball card and a Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought to myself, this is not going to be for everybody. Right, but we'll get somebody who is into this. As God is my witness, about midway through the night, we had this kid, maybe 8 or 9 years old, dressed up as a baseball player, who came up and was just like, "Hi, trick or treat!" And he reached in, and he looked up, and he goes, "There are baseball cards in here." And I said, "Buddy, you take as many of those as you want." And he goes, "Seriously?" I said, "Take 50 of them."
Oh my God.
Go nuts. Question. And I feel like I made his Halloween.
Question.
Yeah.
Were these cards, were these like modern cards? Did you open up a bunch of new packs, like Tops, you know, 2022 or whatever?
Tops 2021. Yep.
So it wasn't like you didn't go out and buy like a case of Stadium Club cards for like $12 on eBay.
No.
And then just
dump all those in there. No, be like, enjoy your John Olerud.
Nope. All modern players.
Here's
all
a Kirby
modern
Puckett
cards
for you.
These are pretty nice stuff too. I got some Donruss optics, some Panini Mosaic, the first time ever. It was great. And threw some NBA
Tops
cards
like
in there
lose
too.
Lose the rights to baseball cards.
That's the whole thing. We'll talk about it in another show. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point is, it was awesome, and I made one kid's night. That kid,
that's
when
nice.
He is 20 years old.
Yeah,
we'll talk to his friends.
I always remember.
Man, I remember there was this one house that I trick or treated at when I was a kid. They let me get like 50 baseball cards.
Was he the only one who took baseball cards, or did everyone take
baseball
cards?
No, some people took cards, some people didn't, but he was the only one who was clearly super into it. Like, this kid clearly collects cards at home, you know, like knew what they were, knew what was going on, and I was just watching him as he left, like rifling through what he did, and he was just like, oh, look at that, oh.
That's nice.
Made me feel good. That's
very
all.
Nice.
Victory,
did
how
you put
are you,
them
buddy?
In the, did you put them in the plastic sleeves? Or were they just getting their grubby little fingerprints all over them?
Grubby little fingerints.
Ugh.
But I keep the penny sleeves now.
Those cards are
1.0s. Sleeves for the hits. Penny sleeves are for the hits.
Do you have any of the screw down ones? The ones with the screws?
Nobody uses them anymore. Those things, soft touches, are done with magnets.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Oh, wow. Magnets.
So, because the screw cases like are ridiculous, right? Once you screw it in, you're like, eh. So, yeah.
I just want to say again, you know, sharing this, I wasn't sure how we were going to do this logistically to do this.
You're talking about Paul Crookston.
I'm talking about Paul still.
About Paul Crookston for the show that nobody will listen to for another 3 days.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I'd say the most disturbing thing about having him here on screen with me is the difference in sizes of our heads on one screen. I don't know. JBL's nodding. You noticed it.
I didn't want to say it.
You could fit Paul's head inside my head with room to spare.
Well, it's like Bert and Ernie. Like, his head is narrow.
Yes. And why is
yours? You got a big, big round.
I started just staring. Move back from the goddamn microphone. Why am I yelling? I started just staring at myself in the screen. And I was mesmerized by it. It was freakish. It was disturbing.
Like a bird.
Okay. So, Sonny, what I wanted to tell you is, Sonny, you were absolutely right. Dune is amazing on IMAX.
You went to go see it on IMAX?
Yes. So what happened was I went to see The French Dispatch, but I got there early. And you know how they have 25 minutes of trailers? So yeah. I got there early. And so I just happened to pop into the IMAX theater out of curiosity, and there was a Dune playing, and I just, like, as I said, it's either that or The Eternals. If it's The Eternals, I am not going to see that. So I walked in, It had started, obviously, already. I just walked in the middle of it. The whole place, by the way, was packed. The IMAX theater, it was crowded. So I had to look for an open seat. I took one on the side in the aisle.
Which theater?
This is in Tyson's.
Okay.
Tyson's. And I sat there. But even, you know, it's funny. They always make the argument. They claim that, oh, every seat's a good seat in the house. And I'm skeptical of that. Yeah, JBL's shaking his head. So I'm there just where, you know, the access, the little path between the two sections are. I'm behind that. And
wait, were you there to watch the whole movie or just to watch 25 minutes?
Just to watch 25 minutes while I'm waiting for the trailers to end. And so I got a little bit of Dune action, and wow, the sound.
Which part were you?
It had just started. Okay. Oh, so I walked in, and it's the part that JVL was marveling at, which is the high priest comes down, the representatives of the emperor, the delegation. It's quite a scene. And then, of course, Gurney sparring with Paul, and then
brutal.
Yeah, a great line. He does it so well. And then after that, a little bit on House Harkonnen and their home planet. Movie. Just fantastic. Anyway, so I'm glad I
good
got
movie.
To see it on. I'm glad I got to see it on IMAX.
C plus in the quadrants.
You should watch. You should
well,
go. You should.
Yeah, no nudity.
Well, it's too late now. IMAX. I mean, you would have to go tonight, or tomorrow you could go midday, but it's Dune will be done in IMAX unless they bring it back in, like, December.
The Eternals isn't actually playing right now, is it?
Eternals starts on Thursday night.
Okay, I was going
to
say, because
by the time people are listening to this, Eternals will have taken over all of the large, premium large format screens.
Okay. Well,
sadly,
that's all I had to you, but I had for you guys.
I'm glad that you at least experienced a tiny sliver of what it's like to see that movie in all its glory.
Did you ever do that as a kid? Like, go?
No, I never snuck into theaters and stole from the movie theaters and stole from the movie studios.
It's not stealing from the creators.
You didn't. You paid for the French Dispatch.
Well, you know, same
you didn't pay for the French Dispatch and dude,
IMAX.
You're stealing from.
How much
here,
be?
Let me count. Let me count all the people you're stealing from. You're stealing from the movie theater because they're getting less ticket revenue. You're stealing from the movie studio.
It's a free seat.
You're stealing from the movie studio who doesn't get any of the revenue of that. You're stealing from the movie distributor. Think of Warner Brothers not getting their 15% off the top. You're stealing from Oscar Isaac and Timothy Chalamet. You're taking money right out of their pockets. They're not getting any of these residual payments.
I feel as terrible about that as when I took the extra mochi from the
Can we get the priest? Can you go get the priest right now? The priests are in your house, JBL.
You bring them in here and you have them berate.
Mm-hmm. You have them berate Victor Reno.
It's not even close to impure acts and impure thoughts. Okay.
You're off the clock.
Thank you. They're off the clock. That's right. Okay.
I don't think priests go off the clock. I don't think that's allowed. I think they're on 24/7. If I walked up to a priest on the street and I was like, I gotta get this off my chest. You have to listen to me. I think they would have to take my confession, right?
Sure. That's how it works.
Isn't that how it works?
Sure.
All right. Well, the priest can comment in the comment section.
Speaking of Dune, over the weekend, Dune remained at the top of the box office with $15.4 million, followed by Halloween Kills. It's still killing. In second place with $8.7 million, and in third place, No Time to Die, with 7.8 million box office thoughts on the drop.
I don't have anything.
62% drop for Dune is about what you would expect for a movie that is playing day and date on HBO Max. It's better than some of the drops. Some of the bigger movies have dropped between 69% and 71%. 62% not terrible. So,
man, Dune part 2 is going to be awesome.
In 2 years,
yes.
October 20. Did you see that they put it on the calendar? October 2023.
I believe it.
Alongside Paw Patrol 2. Think of that double feature.
Which is going to make more money?
The treats must flow.
which is going to make more money? That's what I want to know. Paw Patrol 2.
Paw Patrol 2.
Oh.
Dune Part 2 probably will, because I assume Paw Patrol 2 will also be on Paramount Plus. And Dune Part 2 will not be on HBO Max.
Really?
So, yeah, Legendary, in their negotiation with Warner Brothers, was like, You have to put this in theaters and theaters alone.
Will we get to see the Emperor? I can't remember it in the original one.
I don't think
we see the Emperor at the end.
I don't think you see the Emperor. In the book, you do?
Yes.
I don't remember. I haven't read the book.
Because the Emperor comes down to Arrakis with the Harkonnens for the... You know, yeah, okay. Unimportant.
And you read this book and you hated the book, which is even worse. I hate reading something and not liking it. It's like, ugh, okay.
You're right over there, JVL. You seem crotchety.
No, you know what? I really want to talk about French Dispatch.
Okay, we'll get to it. Listen, if that's all you have to say about... the box office thoughts. Thank you, Sonny, for sharing your big screen box office thoughts. Now, speaking of boxes on the big screen, this week we're talking about The French Dispatch.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right, JVL, which came in 10th place with $2.6 million in select theaters.
Yeah, it's still only in like 700 theaters, yeah. Something like that. So.
I saw mine in... Oh, I saw it at Tyson's, of course. Sonny, how about a big boy review?
So The French Dispatch is the new movie from Wes Anderson. It is very Wes Anderson in that it has lots of very meticulously and fussily framed shots and set designs and lots of, you know, kind of... I hate the description of his movies as dollhouse-like, but there is that kind of aesthetic to it where he is setting things up and playing with his toys, and his toys just happen to be like Benicio del Toro and
your good friend
Léa Seydoux and Frances McDormand. So describing this movie, here's how I would describe this movie. It is a series of short stories that are constructed to resemble the final issue of a magazine that is very much like The New Yorker. It's called The French Dispatch. It was created by Arthur Howitzer Jr., who was played by Bill Murray. And he lives in Ennui, France. Ennui sur Blas or some
sur Blasé.
Such nonsense.
Sur Blasé.
And is... again, the way the film is structured, it's four short stories, a very in brief one, the first of which is narrated by Owen Wilson. The second is
Talk of the Town.
It's basically the Talk of the Town
first
section,
one
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the first one is. The first full story is called The Concrete Masterpiece, which is a consideration of the business of art by J.K.L. Berenson, who's played by Tilda Swinton. The middle story is a look at the politics and aesthetics of revolution by Lucinda Kremetz, who is played by Frances McDormand. And the final story is told by Jeffrey Wright's Roebuck Wright, the private dining room of the police commissioner. And it's one of those kind of classic New Yorker stories that begins as one thing and turns into something else. In this case, it's the profile of a chef who cooks for the police, but it turns into a chase for a kidnapped young man. I'm not going to sit here and talk very specifically about the plot of each of these short stories and list all of the characters and the names of all the actors who play them, because I feel like it is a waste of the time of the podcast to do that. I will just mention, I want to rattle off some of the names of the people who are in this movie, though. There's Benicio del Toro, there's Adrian Brody, Léa Seydoux, Timothy Chalamet, Stephen Park, Bob Balaban, Henry Winkler, Christoph Waltz, Matthew Amalric, Liev Schreiber, Edward Norton, Willem Dafoe, Saoirse Ronan, and just like a ton of other people. I mean, this is one of the most stacked casts I've ever seen.
I didn't even recognize her. She was a kidnapper.
She's one of the kidnapped. She's one of the call girls, Shorsha, one of the dance girls. Saoirse Ronan. What I instead want to highlight is the way in which each of the main short stories, the three main short stories, The Concrete Masterpiece, Revisions of a Manifesto, and The Private Dining Room of the Police Commissioner. The way each one of those short stories kind of represents a different aspect of art and artists and the business of art, because that is what this movie is actually about. This movie is about is about appreciating art in all of its forms. And I feel very strongly about this, because some folks have dismissed this movie as fussy for the sake of fussiness, that it is Wes Anderson indulging his tics and whatever just because he can't do anything else. And I think that's wrong exactly. I think the fussiness is part of the point here. So the first story is, again, it's The Concrete Masterpiece, and it's about a crazed psychopathic killer who is actually a extremely talented artist. He is a master of modern art. And that is about indulging an artist and accepting his work for what it is, to a certain extent. And it's also about the ways in which, you know, hype men actually create, can help create artists and help make them renowned and that sort of stuff. But it is about indulging talent. And then the middle story, Revisions to a Manifesto, that is about collaboration. That is about how the artists need to work with other people and how no true work of art is ever made, on your own, by yourself. And then, again, the final story here is the private dining room of the police commissioner. And that is... That one is the most interesting to me visually, because the way that Wes Anderson kind of constructs some of these shots, these split screens where you get an image of the food that's been created alongside an image of the people eating it. There's almost too much going on at any one time to actually see what's happening
and
in the
reading.
Shots. It's like it's hard. It's actually hard to see kind of what is happening and what is going on. And again, the fussiness here is the point. He is showing that, you know, what is fine dining except a form of art, right? What is fine dining except the distillation of years of experience into an activity that people will enjoy for 5 minutes per course, you know, an hour for a meal, right? It is filmmaking itself in very miniature form. It is taking all of the skills and all of the talents that you have acquired to give people an experience they will remember for the rest of their life that is, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours long. That's what it is. And I love this. I don't think it's his best movie, and I don't think it's his most profound movie. I think Grand Budapest Hotel and Isle of Dogs are two of the most interesting kind of modern meditations on the aesthetics of fascism that we've seen on aesthetics and the rise of fascism that we've seen in recent years from any film director. But this is, I think, a really interesting meditation on the nature of art and what it means to be an artist who is trying to create things that appeal to the people who give him money, to himself, and to the audiences. I mean, like, that is what these three stories are. It's a balancing act of all of those different things. I'm done.
Wow. I didn't think about any of that, obviously. I just enjoyed the
Vic,
movie.
What were you focused on?
Well, let's see.
What
here.
Were you let's say from minutes like 15
okay,
to 20
here we
or
go.
So.
So the plot is an A. It's pretty straightforward. I don't think I was confused. Duration is an A. It's tight. It's like, what, an hour 45, I think? Something like that? Something
yeah, hour 50. Yeah.
Action violence actually is like a B+. It's not bad. You know, there was stuff going on. And sex nudity was A++.
Three pluses.
That gives you a French Dispatch quadrant score of A. I haven't, for whatever reason, I have it in parentheses. It was A++, and then A+, and then just A, and then A-, and then I woke up later on, 15 minutes later. So that's where... That's where it was. I enjoyed it largely. I didn't like how long the animated sequence went on in the chase. Okay, I guess it's his homage
there's
to cartoons.
A, so there's
but.
Yeah, there's an animated sequence in the private dining room of the police commissioner that is designed to look like the New Yorker will occasionally do cartoons.
Yeah,
of this sort.
Yes,
and it is designed to look like that. And again, it is like, I think you're right, Vic. It goes on a bit. It's a bit self-indulgent, but
yes.
A lot of this movie is self-indulgent.
Right. I don't know how many other people
to its benefit.
I don't know how many other people will enjoy it in the way that we do, having worked at a magazine.
I want to talk about that in a little
knowing
bit.
Knowing all the certain types, and it also made me wonder. Thank you. It also made me wonder how connected Wes Anderson was it was pretty on the nose with certain things, and I found myself laughing out loud in certain parts in the beginning when they're doing the, and no one else is laughing, but every, you know, laughing out loud. I loved as brief a cameo as it was for Elizabeth Moss, to have her standing in front of a sentence diagram that extreme and being the grammarian and at the editorial meetings. But also, okay, and I'm going to pass this on to JVL, but the thing that had me laughing the most.
Yes. Is it when Zeffirelli asks her to proof his thing and she starts critiquing it and he said, I just wanted to proof it so that you could tell me how good it already is.
Yes,
that is the most writer thing ever.
Yes. No, it's absolutely.
I laughed out loud.
It is. It's the Mike Kinsley line about the best writer is the one who submits his copy and then gets hit by a bus. But no, the one I loved is in the introduction, and they're talking about the different kinds of people that worked at the French Dispatch, and they said, and the writer who shows up at the office every day but has never published anything, and sort of throughout the movie, he's hanging out, he's having an app, he's having a snack, and he's reading copy, and he's contributing editorially speaking, but wow, that was just... You know, for me and for you, I'm sure, you know, we know so many weird people. JVL, what are your thoughts on this movie?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I want to talk about it is because the three of us can have a conversation about the French Dispatch that I wonder if anybody else can have. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah,
it feels to me as if this movie is totally inaccessible unless you have worked for a magazine of ideas.
And also love The New Yorker, or at least the way it was.
Even loving it as an outsider is different from having worked for a magazine of ideas. A magazine of ideas is a very specific kind of... Now, look, I'm sure I can watch The Player and find bits of it interesting ways, but if I'm not in the industry, I'm sure I'm missing 15 different levels of... Mm-hmm. Smart stuff and funny things because I don't actually know Hollywood, right? I'm only an outside observer, three rungs removed from it. So there are a bunch of things I didn't like about the movie, and even at 1:47, it's at least 15 minutes too long. Each of the three main pieces drags longer than it should be by about 5 minutes. The score, which shocks me for a Wes Anderson movie, each of the three long pieces has a single score in the back of it, which is essentially like a pattern of eight measures repeating over and over, almost like video game.
Is this Alexander Desplat or no?
I have no idea, but it's annoying, and I wanted it to stop. I wanted to be able to mute that thing in the back because it just wouldn't stop. It was just over and over and over and over and over again. And, you know...
Oh. Yes, particularly during the riots, that part.
All of them. Each one of them has a different pattern in the background, but it's just the same, again, eight measures looped over and over. Those things aside, I loved it. I loved it so much, and I just felt like it was a love letter to our world from somebody who somehow understood our world.
I don't know how many movies are there out there like that. You know.
None.
It's this and Shattered Glass.
Yes. Oh, no, I love Shattered Glass. Yeah.
And this is what people don't understand. Like, this isn't really a journalism movie. It's a movie about magazines of ideas, which are a very distinct subset of journalism.
Yeah. It's not All the President's Men.
There's a ton for us to talk about. There is. And I love the structure of it. From the opening frame with Angelica Houston as the narrator in the Alec Baldwin role of setting the table for it, to the unspooling of the stories as if we the viewer are paging through the magazine.
A magazine, absolutely.
Again, with the talk of the town, then the arts, right? Mm-hmm. So the first one is the arts. The next one is the news of the day, right? You know, the more topical
news of the day. That's right.
The student riots, and then to the closing thing, which is supposed to be about food, right? Which, again, is just how this is how the rhythms of magazines work when you're a reader. You make your way through them. And then even to the obituary and the idea of the collaborative writing
and that is
the last minute. I love the crap out of it.
Yeah. Sonny. You felt the same way, I assume.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, the thing that jumps out at me, the thing that, that Anderson and his co-writers and his collaborators understand is the role that Arthur Howitzer Jr. plays in the magazine as the editor, as the kind of guiding light, right? So the funniest thing
convincingly.
About the funniest thing about Murray's performance here is the leeway with which the leeway that he grants his writers, right? The ways in which he is exceptionally tolerant of all of their quirks, of all of their nonsense, the way he's almost pleading with them to you know, either file or whatever, and the way that the thing that he's most concerned about is expenses, and he's trying to figure out why Lucinda Cremens has charged a week at a seaside hotel so she can write the thing instead of just writing it at her desk,
at her office. Yeah.
Or when he picks up the scrap of paper that Jeffrey Wright's Roebuck Wright has thrown to the ground, and he reads what is the heart of the piece.
That's right.
Back to him, and he says, "You have to put this back in. This is it." And the writer's like, "Ugh, fine."
No, but this is a beautiful bit of business. So he reads it, and the editor's character, Bill Murray's character, recognizes that this is in fact the best part of the piece, and he says to him, "This is the best part of the piece." And Jeffrey Wright's response is, "No, it's not. I disagree." And he doesn't fight him on it. He just says, "Well, anyway, you have to put it back in."
Yeah.
Which is exactly,
and that's
again,
the dynamic.
That
the
is
dynamic
how with, editors have to manage writers, right? Like, so you don't get into an argument over whether it's the best part or not. You just say, okay, look, you're entitled to this in. Has to be in somewhere.
Even if you disagree. That's right. Editors are therapists. Writers are weird. Editors are weird.
But also, let me finish my distracted. My point here was that in addition to being totally tolerant of the writers, he's a monster to everybody else. He's, he is demanding that the illustrator do the thing correctly. And I mean, not a monster, but he's brusque. He's like, brusque. Do this, mm-hmm. do that, with the printing and the guy running around, telling them when it's going to go to press and everything. He's just like, you do it this way or you're out. And again, that's just right. I mean, it just hit the exact right note.
Well, because there's a difference between the magazine staff and the staff writers, because the staff writers are spending most of their time
the talent and the,
out there.
The gaffers.
It's not just that is not right. The people who are putting out the magazine with him are with him every day. And that's why I read
Moss,
your review when you were saying, oh, he's brusque and stuff. He's a monster. I just don't think that's right. He's brusque, but they get it. They're in on the dynamic. And he doesn't really mean it. He's just like more brusque because they're working together every single day, whereas the writers flit in and out. Right. I mean, Jeffrey Wright is out chasing around for 3 weeks and then he comes back and drops this off. It's just they're like guest stars in a magazine. No, they're not, not the immediate family of the magazine.
I didn't mean to suggest that anybody took it. I mean, this is the other thing, is that everybody gets along famously. I don't think anybody had their feelings hurt when Arthur Howitzer Jr. is like, no, draw it like this, or, whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it is.
He has a vision for the magazine. This is right. So great magazines have editors who have visions for them and who have interesting obsessions, right? This is a famous John Podism, that a magazine is a collection of the editor's obsessions, and if the editor is an interesting person, then the magazine will be interesting. Mm-hmm. This is why commentary is so great. Right, because John has like super interesting obsessions and a very strong vision for it, and he brings it all together, and commentary reflects John.
Right,
and that's why it's so good.
And capable writers to deploy that.
Yeah, but in service of he knows what he likes.
Did you like the very short scene about the very arbitrary word rates, the way writers are paid? He's like, okay, pay. I mean, it's an exaggeration and it's absurd because it's like, oh, for the next 15 years, he gets X amount of, X dollars or francs or whatever it is. But it is true. I mean, all writers are treated differently. Writers don't like to think about it that way when you're on the bottom of that. But the other writers on top like to think about it that way, And I always say, look, I mean, and the other thing I always tell people is, if you go into the business, writers and editors, especially writers, are weird. And if they weren't weird, they'd have normal jobs. You know,
Noemi Emery, right? I mean, you could see Noemi Emery in these characters, right?
Yeah. She's wandering around, around. You know, like, again, like, people, are, they're just there, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I...
Or writers who walk around in our old office, they would be barefoot or in socks.
Well, and you wind up with people who are like barnacles, right? They glom on, and you're not even quite sure how they got there, but they just become part of the furniture, right? They're like, we just collected this person, right? They started as an intern, and now they're here, and now, you know, they're just... How did we get to this? Oh, who knows? They just, you know, they're part of the magazine now.
Yes.
Are you guys students of The New Yorker? I am a on again, off again subscriber to The New Yorker, but not
anymore
at all. Not at all a student of like the history of The New Yorker.
Oh, I like old New Yorker.
Yeah, I mean the only character I recognized was again the writer who was on staff forever but never actually filed anything. That's based on a real guy, right? That's like a
The first thing that came to my mind was Joe Mitchell, but only because he had stopped writing after I think Joe Gould's Secret, and that was what in the 60s or whenever it was. And the funny story about when Tina Brown took over, and Joe Mitchell was still coming to the office, and then he mentions to her, like on an elevator somewhere, that he was thinking about writing something. And of course, it would be the biggest thing ever if he actually did, because it would have been like 30 years since he last wrote or whatever it was, since Joe Gould's Secret. And she's like, of course, Mr. Mitchell, you know, we'd be honored by that. Okay, great. I'll file it, whatever. He never filed it, you know. It just continues on. There are a lot of things. I'll tell you the one thing, the obituary, if I can jump to the end, the obituary thing. It reminded me of my old friend Arnold Beichmann, the late Soviet
tyrant. Arnold Beichmann.
Arnold, who died in his 90s. He was probably 96. And I was out in Stanford, and we were hanging out, and he told me about the death of Elliot Cohen. And this is, and I'm curious if Pod listens, I'm sure his father might have a different version of this event, but Arnold told me. And this was 1959, and Elliot was the editor and founder of Commentary before Norman took over, and he had died. And he had so Arnold gets a call from the wife saying to come to the apartment because Elliot had died and he had committed suicide. And so he comes over to the apartment, and there, in fact, is Elliot, and he's on the kitchen floor. And this is terrible. Did you call the police? And Elliot's wife says, no, I called you first because, I just thought you should know. And Arnold said, well, that's okay, good. I think we need to call the other, the managing editor, or the other editors, and let them know as well because it's important for them. And then they show up, and then they say, well, we need to tell the writers. So the writers show up, and Arnold said, by the time the police showed up, the apartment was packed, and Elliot's body is still there on the floor, and people are standing. They had started to make themselves drinks. And they were saying things like, this is awful. I can't believe this happened. By the way, that was a great review in the last issue. Oh, thank you. Yeah, what are you working on now? Because writers are weird like that. But I watched that, and I wondered if Wes Anderson knew that or not. But that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Again, I thought of Naomi Emery and just all of the people that collect at a place. But the other thing about French Dispatch is, and if you're not in the business, you don't understand this. It is also a very bittersweet look at a thing which is going away. Those sorts of long-form journalism, they still exist, right? And The New Yorker can still do it. There are tons and tons of places online, like Believer and The Atavist and Omnichrome, and all. There are lots of places that can put out long-form journalism. But they can only do that as a waste of resources because it is important to the people who run the publication. There is no way to justify economically the amount of resources it takes to produce a great piece of long-form journalism, right? To get a 14,000-word piece in which somebody goes and runs around with the chief of police for 3 weeks costs a ton of money.
Right.
You've got to carry somebody's entire living expenses, their entire salary for a month to get that, right? At least, maybe more.
To get one piece.
To get one piece, right? And you can do that if you, like, if you're Texas Monthly and you're really committed to this, you can do that a few times a year, but there's no reason to do it except that you're committed to keeping this kind of art form alive.
Right.
And so I look at this as a very bittersweet picture.
It was bittersweet. Because now it's, you know, how many clicks are you going to get and how do you monetize this? And
it's, we just missed it.
Engagements, impressions. Yeah, that's right.
Just missed it. We were 10 years too late to have lived in this world that we wanted to live in. Like, we saw it, we understood it, we knew we wanted to live in it.
20 years, even better.
And we just missed it.
And we were there on the, as it was changing already. Yeah. So, like, filing systems and things like that. And as it was going, everything was being digitized. I mean, it was just, it was the tail end of
the
that
last
world.
Days of disco.
It was just a small, just a glimpse of what that used to be like, because people can't believe that we, you know, when we started, we didn't have email, you know? And the internet was, it was just happening at that time with web crawler and things like that. And, you know,
can we talk some perfs?
Oh, sure. Definitely.
Sure.
Adrian Brody.
Oh yeah.
Is fantastic in this.
I love Adrian Brody in every Wes Anderson movie. Mm-hmm. So we did at Across the Movie Aisle in our bonus episode this week for Bulwark subscribers. We talked about our favorite Wes Anderson performances on that show, and I picked Adrian Brody because anytime he shows up in a Wes Anderson movie, he is like the most interesting thing on the screen. And I am convinced it's because he simply looks like one of Wes Anderson's stop motion animation dolls.
Yeah.
He has this kind of like Gumby like quality to him where he is angular and he is thin and his head is very long. And when he talks, he will frequently like move at angles. He will like lean forward at a very precise angle or lean to the side at a very precise angle. Again, like you would position a doll. And I love him in this. I love him in all of the Wes Anderson movies he is in. And it's interesting to compare him to like Timothy Chalamet, who I think is like not bad in this movie, but is also clearly just outclassed by everybody else who knows precisely what they are doing and like precisely how kind of fussy and mannered they need to be in each of those roles. And he's just he's trying to do it and he can't. He just doesn't have that gear. Yeah,
did you like his girlfriend in that story?
Yes.
Yes.
What did
Frances
you like?
McDormand, you mean?
What did you like about her, Victorino?
I thought she had a great profile.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Wright. Can we just a moment about Jeffrey Wright?
Oh, he's wonderful. I can't believe. Anyway, we just saw him in No Time to Die.
His performance here might be the best performance I've seen in a film this year.
Yeah.
I just thought he was absolutely dynamite. And he and Liev Schreiber together... The two of them, just as voice actors, the two of them are astonishing.
They are also, those two in that segment are also paying tribute to another kind of long-form journalism that is long gone. The Dick Cavett style one-on-one sit-down.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Interview, discussion, you know, long-form interview. That you just don't, there is not that anymore. It does not exist.
The, you know who I liked also was the chef in that segment, played by Stephen Park.
Stephen Park.
If you remember, that's Mike Yanagita from Fargo. You know, Marge, I'm so lonely. Yeah. I'm so lonely, Marge. And of course, Frances McDormand is in that movie as well. Everybody's old now. But and it's so funny because his name is Nescafier. Like Nescafe, but also a riff on Escoffier, right? Escoffier was the famous the French chef who... from 100 years back or whatever it was. It was from who became prominent in the 1890s and then teamed up with Cesar Ritz at the Savoy. Really interesting stuff and supposed to be as demanding, et cetera. And a little known factoid, by the way, Escoffier in Paris, you know who was one of his busboys was Ho Chi Minh.
Ooh.
If only he gave him a job. Anyway. But there's so many other great performances.
Victory. You know? Well, how about Léa Seydoux?
I loved her.
This is a great perf, right?
Again, yeah. Well, you know what's funny? Yeah, great perf. Nice perf. She and Jeffrey Wright, it's so funny. They were both in No Time to Die, and yet they were both really good in... they were fine in No Time to Die, but they were really good, I thought, in the French Dispatch. And
what did you like about what Seydoux did with her character?
Well, you know, I don't know. I feel like I'm beating around the bush with this answer, but so I do have a question, Sonny.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe JVL knows. But how does the movie escape an NC-17 rating with Full Frontal? Because I thought Full Frontal would require that. No, am I wrong?
No.
I mean, I'm glad I'm wrong. I'm just saying, you know, no, that's okay.
We get Full Frontal all the time. You get Full Frontal in The Suicide Squad.
Right, it's
full
more like
in The Big Lebowski.
It's more like what you're doing. It's more like what you're doing.
Full Frontal. Full Frontal is not in and of itself an NC-17. Though male Full Frontal nudity is generally judged a little more harshly than mm-hmm. female, kind of famously. But like it's about sex. I mean, if there's not thrusting.
Oh right, it's the action. It's the action versus
more,
right.
It's more I mean, and again, this was
like
very
brown,
artfully
like brown
done.
Bunny.
This was very artistic.
JVL's laughing. Remember that one?
Vincent Gallo in Chloe Sevigny.
Well,
in that movie, they have oral sex on screen.
But
artistically.
Speaking of characters in The Office, that was like I remember it was our late art director. Our late art director, Lev. And may he rest in peace. But he was like, Vicky, have you seen Brown Bunny? Chloe Sevigny and auto sex not simulated. He was very excited about it, you know. It was like, oh, thank you.
The eyebrows,
okay.
Right?
Yeah, the eyebrows. I said, okay, all right, good to know. Thank you.
And then he stabbed you.
did you overlap with him too, Sonny?
Oh yeah, I love Lev. We always got along fine. I got along with most everyone. In the Weekly Standard. I managed to you know.
He told some terrible jokes. I can't even tell here on
there. There are names I want to mention from the Weekly Standard I'm just not going to mm-hmm. because I don't want to call anyone out.
But doing what? Like
just again, it was a lot of the like the guy who was like standing around not writing and eating apples all the time. But like always there, always there, reminded me very much of somebody who left while I was there.
If you remember, I have to think about that one. I can't wait for the after show. Yes,
Tilda Swinton. Can I briefly just talk about her accent?
Funny.
Her accent is that was. It's like a vaguely Peggy Noonan-ish. Accent that in you can't quite figure out
Midwestern-ish, but and she had the funny teeth. She had the funny right. So she has this teeth and it's goofy. Great. And she's.
I don't typically like Tilda Swinton. I thought she was dynamite.
She plays a great villain in Michael Clayton. But you're right. Generally, I'm not a big fan of her. She's
great. Well, no, and she just that the whole shtick where she is giving that presentation as if she's in an art society, but that's actually just. That's not really happening. That is the piece speaking. That is what her writerly voice is of her. Because that whole thing is like an impressionistic version of what her piece is.
There's nudity of her.
Maybe I don't tell if that was.
I don't think that's actually her.
Yeah, I don't think that was. I don't think that was.
I saw
her at all.
It's
different.
It was
body double, Victorino.
I think that's a 30 year younger.
I was so interested by that. Anyway, continue. Is this the most nudity in a Wes Anderson movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
By a fair amount. I was thinking about this. I was thinking about this during the movie because I was like, well, I know that Vic's gonna like this one. As I texted you, I think shortly after I got out of it.
Yeah, because at first when you're watching Benicio del Toro, and he's doing his painting and Lea Seydoux is the nude subject and you see her full frontal, but from a distance, I'm like, wow, already it's, you're off to a strong start here. And then he moves up and he walks up to her close. I'm like, wow, you gotta be kidding me.
I was saying about this, the only other instances of nudity that I can remember in a Wes Anderson film are, is Royal Tenenbaums.
Mm.
Revo Ghosh.
When Margot Tenenbaum is with her lady friend.
Yes.
I think that might be it.
I just watched that movie 2 days ago.
There may be some in The Life Aquatic as well.
The script girl. The script girl is topless.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Also, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Number of the Animals Were Naked.
Yes.
So can true. I...
No, they all wear clothes.
They did.
Can I say something? The fact that the editor's will stipulates that the entire magazine be shut down and never publish again upon his death is interesting to me because it suggests something which I never used to really believe in, right? I used to believe that magazines should be for forever. And the whole idea of a magazine is that it should be an institution that goes mm-hmm. for forever, right?
After
you want the Atlantic.
After your
you
time,
want you want the Atlantic there. Publishing for 125 years. You want the New Yorker publishing for a century. But it is better for a magazine of ideas to die and go away than to become a zombie version of itself.
Yeah, because you see that.
Because
you
when
see
you
that a
see
lot.
Magazines oh. that are zombie versions of themselves, and you just think to yourself, this is just sad. And yeah. it really does.
Whichever iteration of the New Republic we're on right now.
I'll see it sometimes, across, yes, and you think that it was the same publication that had Fred Barnes, Mike Kelly, Charles Krauthammer, Andrew Sullivan, and Mike Kinsley, yeah. and, you know, it's, wow.
It's, and it really does tarnish the legacy. I mean, look at what Vanity Fair has become, right? Vanity Fair was a serious magazine of ideas and letters, mm-hmm. and it is not that anymore. It's not even close.
Yeah, and they used to have some big essays in there too.
I mean, I always thought of Vanity. I mean, maybe this is just because I'm young and am you know less into. But I always thought of Vanity Fair as like a slightly smarter Vogue, anyway. Not really.
Well, it has been in our lifetimes, but it didn't used to be. It used to be serious. Mm-hmm. You know, the Atlantic has had a revival, which is great. But there are other places, you know, like we don't have to gap on them, which you just think,
when
it's
I was,
sad.
When I was in the airport, early in October during Columbus weekend. And, I still go to the magazine rack to see what's there. And you'll come across some like, oh, it looks terrible now. You know, as it's just, it's a shadow of what it once was.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite sort of old New Yorker writers that you like or that you've taken to over the years, JVL or Sonny?
My favorites are all, for me, the New Yorker is like Saturday Night Live. Like the best cast is Saturday Night Live when you were in high school, right? That's the golden age. Mm-hmm. And for me, the golden age of the New Yorker is the New Yorker of my 20s, which, of course, objectively it wasn't.
Yeah.
Objectively, it wasn't because mm-hmm. that's a lot of like the Tina Brown New Yorker.
Sure.
Objectively, the David Remnick is better. But I loved the Tad Friend stuff.
Oh, he was good.
Loved David Graham. God, I love David Graham so much.
Oh, man, David Graham. Yeah, definitely.
Ken Auletta is great. I don't know. Everybody at the New Yorker except for Andy Borowitz is great.
Yeah.
I don't understand how a magazine
nobody, I don't
is
think
so
anybody
smart
does, but
else
obviously
is.
There's somebody up there
Boomer
who
bait.
Thinks that
it's
he's
just
hilarious.
Well, no, it's not somebody at the New Yorker. It is the legions of 50 to 100-year-old boomers who are very into his very specific brand of boomer comedy.
I guess,
and it's,
but you know, in honesty, the shouts and murmurs sections, even when Steve Martin is writing it, I never find it funny.
Mm.
And I know people love Steve Martin. People mm-hmm. think Steve Martin is a comedic genius, and he probably is. I'm not, you know, who am I to say he's not? But people, that is, for me, that's a section of the magazine which isn't for me,
mm-hmm.
in which I just don't, in the same way Rick Hertzberg's editorials have never been for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when I agree with him, I basically find them the most weakly written part of the magazine. It's just not for me. But that's the thing about great magazines, is that there are whole chunks that are for different audiences. The idea is that you are not meant to read the whole thing cover to cover.
Yeah, I don't.
There's supposed to be sections that appeal to you and sections that appeal to others. The magazine is a gathering place for all these different interests.
For I am not a I am not currently a New Yorker subscriber. I let my subscription lapse. I don't know, a year or so ago. But for the last like 2 years that I subscribed to the magazine, I was subscribing solely to read Anthony Lane every week in the closing section as the film critic. Because I think he is I know a lot of film critics who really really hate him, who think that he like kind of disdains film as an art form. And there is an element of that, but I just love his writing and his sensibility.
Tina brought him.
He is my favorite.
I liked his first run as their film critic. He then took several years off and then came back. And when he came back, he did seem a little bit too jaded to me.
The work that is collected in Nobody's Perfect, his collection of essays.
That's the early stuff. It's amazing.
Is amazing. I mean, like he has this great review of Ronin. That starts something like, as I was watching Robert De Niro pull a rocket launcher from the rooftop of a Audi A7, I realized that I was having a very fun time in this movie. You guys talk.
So Victorino, he has another essay, which he wrote, because again, he would sometimes just write essays about the Birdie and Jeeves. The books.
Yes.
And the whole thing is about his uncle, who is so obsessed with the Birdie and Jeeves books that he has two complete sets of them, one for his downstairs and one for his upstairs, so that if in the middle of the night he wanted to go and look something up, he wouldn't have to walk downstairs. He could walk to the lab. And honest to God, it's 15,000 words about this.
Yeah.
And it's engrossing and fabulous. This story I'm relating right now is why I am positive that nobody who didn't work for a magazine could possibly enjoy the French Dispatch because you and I understand and think this is fascinating.
Oh, I mean,
and I'm sure people have clicked off of the show five minutes ago.
There's five people like, what are they going to go to the Squid Game? I loved in the end, when they say that this film is dedicated to, because I actually spotted my favorite New Yorker,
namely Lillian Hellman.
Yeah, for me, it's A.J. Liebling and a little bit of Joe Mitchell. A.J. Liebling's collected his food. I mean, he did a lot. He did The Sweet Science. He said so. He did boxing, and he did about Huey Long, the Earl of Louisiana, and then and he even did D-Day, but. And I've read his stuff where he's like on a transport ship from Norway to the United States during the war, which really it's long. And yet there's interesting things in there. But for me, it's the food writing that it made me want to be write about food. And that really influenced me. Between Meals is a good book to get. It's easy. It's just lovely about his early years as a kid. It's just fantastic. And then Joe Mitchell, of course, had famous essays like All You Can Hold for $5 about the beefsteak dinners in New York at the time in the late 30s for five. Yeah. And I love all that stuff. That's what it was for me. So I also enjoyed the Jeffrey Wright bit. Sonny.
As Robert De Niro stood up on the front seat of the speeding black Audi and poked the upper half of his body through the sunroof, the better to rest the rocket launcher on his shoulder and aim it at the car in front, I arrived at the mature conclusion that Ronin was, all things considered, a rather enjoyable film. And I feel like that is the essence of film criticism, as far as I'm concerned. Like, you have to accept a film on its own terms and judge it from there. And in that sense, I think the French Dispatch is an enormous success. It sets out to do a thing, which is pen a love letter to this sort of art form, and it does so quite spectacularly successfully.
On that note, do we have any corrections, shout-outs? Okay. That is all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at Sonny Bunch, at Victorina Mattis. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com. We're there. Tell your friends. Until next time. I have something, but if you have something, you go.
Bring it, Victorino.
Oh no, it's short, but okay. The one thing that people don't appreciate now is the letters to the editor. At JVL, you handled the correspondence page. I did
for
it
many years.
You. Sonny, did you ever handle letters to editor? No, that was never your job.
Was never in my portfolio.
And that was a thing that just eventually got phased out, but some places still do it. A couple thoughts, and then worst letter I ever saw. The first is, I remember when people started that email was going to be a thing, and that people were going to be able to send their, you know, like send emails instead of letters to the editor. And I actually thought at the time, among many things I thought that were wrong, that the emails, because it involves a computer, were going to be erudite and much better than the letters to the editor that we had been receiving. Because you get crazy letters, people writing on the envelopes, people writing, you know, people for like, it's like mental institution, and they'll write for like 5-6 pages in very small handwriting. But
regular correspondence. Like you'd get one a month from these, you know.
Yes, that's right.
This is from an insane person.
And your job and my job, we had to open up the envelopes, read the letters. So I said, oh, this will be good when we have email because, you know, these people are probably going to be very intelligent. It's so much worse because, of course, people are just, you know, like they don't put any thought into it. Right. And they don't have to go to the trouble of getting an envelope, putting a stamp on it, the address, and going to the mailbox. They're just, you know, and firing off terrible thoughts that they probably shouldn't commit to. You know what I mean? And then people end up regretting it. So the worst letter I ever saw, it was not to me. It was sent generically to the Weekly Standard. And it was an illustration, somebody in crayon, of Uncle Sam with his pants down and Bill Clinton and Al Gore servicing him, complete with human hair.
What? I can't even say I'm sure it's fine because I don't understand what you just said.
Hair was glued on to parts of Uncle Sam's body.
I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure.